Wayward Pines, episodes 1 and 2 are over, but we are just getting started here on Post Show Recaps. Hello, everyone. My name is Mike Bloom, one of the co-hosts here on Post Show Recaps, and I am joined by a man who I will always let talk about the past. You may know him from his fantastic work over on ESPN and also his coverage here on Post Show Recaps. We've talked before about things like Black Mirror and Grace Point / Broadchurch and a little bit of Lost Lives. It is the one and only AJ Mass. AJ, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's so surprising to talk to you about something that's not British.
I know. Well, let's give it a few episodes. You never know. With this show, creepy British people might just show up in the middle of the street. That would not surprise me at this point.
That's very true. They'd ring us up.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. We're here to talk about this new summer show called Wayward Pines, which came to Fox. It premiered a week ago at the time of recording this, but from what AJ was telling me, I believe it premiered against the, you know, Shonda Rhimes dynasty, the Sean dynasty of season finale. So it kind of got blown out of the water there. So they re-aired it this week with the second episode. It's kind of like a new restarted premiere. So in effect, this is kind of like the season premiere recap. We'll go with that.
Yeah, that's what we'll tell ourselves that anyway.
Exactly. That's what we're going to tell you. That's going to be one of the rules on this podcast. If we say it's one episode, it's a premiere podcast, you have to answer to that. So let's just jump in and I don't have any sort of structure to this because the show is kind of unstructured too, and just how crazy it is in terms of its given circumstances and things it's been setting up. But I want to start a little bit with some background, AJ. When you were searching through, you know, upfronts or looking through, obviously, television news that we frequent too often, what drew you to this show in the first place? Was it a specific actor, a specific person behind it, the concept of it? I'm really intrigued.
Well, I mean, initially, you know, the name that was attached to this show was M. Night Shyamalan. And that brings up, you know, a certain sense of caution.
A lot of mixed feelings, yeah.
A lot of mixed feelings. But, I mean, the fact that it's his first real foray into television, and he wasn't writing the script himself. He was using a trilogy of books, and he was, you know, the script was being written for him. And in that sense, you know, I have always found, regardless of what you think about the twistiest twists that Shyamalan has used over the years that are his bread and butter, I mean, all of the stuff that he's done is just gorgeous to look at. The cinematography is fantastic, and I was just really curious to see how he was going to take that to the small screen more than anything else. But then, you know, watching the trailer and everything and seeing that it was kind of a Twin Peaksy Lost hybrid kind of The Prisoner sort of thing, all of which are shows I love and adore, I thought, well, I have to give it a shot.
Yeah. Could you imagine if M. Night Shyamalan produced a season of Big Brother? Like, could you imagine the twist? Like, hey, just when you thought that this person was, you know, the next person coming to the house was the person, your father, that you thought was dead for the past 3 years, he's alive and he's in the house with you now.
In fact, we learn at the end that they're not actually in the house at all. They're actually on a survivor island somewhere.
Yeah, or like you thought you won the veto, but it turns out to actually just be made of chocolate. It's not a real veto at all. Yeah, that we can only imagine if we end up plumbing the depths of Big Brother one day, maybe that
actually around week six, M. Night Shyamalan himself would enter the house.
Yes. And but he would enter it as like another character.
Yes, exactly. Give himself the greatest eviction speech of all time before suddenly self-evicting or something.
Yeah. But so I would say in terms of my background here, I mean, I completely agree that I think the Shyamalan draw was an interesting draw. I'm totally in the same boat with you. I think the general consensus on M. Night Shyamalan, and I don't want to generalize too much on the media public in general, but I think it seems that M. Night Shyamalan is a little played out at this point. I mean, he hit the scene big with Sixth Sense, and even Unbreakable was a pretty good follow up. But then once we started getting to The Signs and The Village and The Happening, which is I think personally is one of the worst movies I've ever seen in the theater. It is a pretty horrible movie.
What's the matter, Mike? You don't like when the trees are attacking?
I don't like when
the trees are attacking, Mike.
I don't like
you have to
when
get out of the trees.
And to spoil The Happening, when The Happening, the titular Happening, happens off camera. there's a point where, like, you know, there's this whole scene where, like, Mark Wahlberg and Zooey Deschanel and a couple of other people are trying to get into this house. They do, and then, like, they're just hanging out there, and then they hear the wind subside, and Mark Wahlberg walks outside and goes, "Guess it must have happened while we were inside." And it's like, I heard a guy in the theater literally said, like, "Oh, come on!" Like, why would... but this is not a happen cast. Wait, maybe we'll do that later on. But yeah, so I think he's left a weird impression in terms of his writing and directing things, but even his producing credits, I mean, one of his lone movies that he produced and didn't work on at all, really, was Devil in 2010, and I mean, that wasn't a great thing either. But as you said, it's his first foray into TV, and as we know, some movie directors make great TV directors or vice versa. And you know what? I've enjoyed... It's very Shyamalan. The cinematography, you can tell he directed the first episode because it very much resembles that. I'll say that, yeah, the I know from, like, the publicity it was getting, it was very Twin Peaksy from what I hear. I have, and myself, and AJ, I know this is gonna kill you, I've not really gotten to Twin Peaks as of yet. It's on my list, but you so you may have to supplement any sort of references from here on out, but the Lost references, especially the first scene, were obviously there. One other impression that I was really getting, especially throughout the first episode, was the movie The Wicker Man. Then, speaking of other, you know, not so great, yes, modern movies, the Nicolas Cage film where he investigates, like, a kidnapping on this really weird island ran by all females, and there's people getting punched in bear costumes and bees, and it's a romp I might not recommend, or at least I would not recommend sober. But it definitely has a similar mentality. That being said, I would just love base reaction. We're two episodes in and a lot of stuff has already happened that I'm sure we're going to do a deep dive into. What sort of thoughts do you have on the show thus far? And do they differ from what you were thinking about coming into it?
Well, I'm torn because I really want to like it. And I don't know that it's done anything to merit my not liking it. It's just that I've been burned so many times before by network shows trying to do this kind of quirky mystery, what's going on, yeah, we're not sure, on, you know, peel back the layers each week.
Interestingly, almost always starring Lost characters, you know, between Flash Forward and Revolution and Alcatraz.
And actually one that came a few years back that this is really similar to was a show called Persons Unknown. Starring Jason Wiles, and that was kind of like, again, it was billed as this, it's a 13 episode kind of limited run thing with a beginning, middle, and end, and you'll never believe what happens, and it was going along, and I was all in, I was like really digging it, and then NBC just never showed the last 3 weeks of it, because there was NFL football, and they just kind of, it was delayed in all the major markets, and they just never re-aired it. If you missed it, you missed it. Oh, well. And I was like, ugh. So yeah, I just, that kind of, like, that fear of mine, you know, if this was going to be a show that was possibly, you know, a full commitment with a possibility of a season two. And yes, I know every show possibly could have a season two. I mean, look at what happened with Under the Dome. But, you know, if I knew this was ongoing, I probably would have bailed already. But because I know it's a 10 episode beginning, middle, and end, I'm willing to stick around for that limited type of commitment to see if there's a there at the end of this, because I want to be surprised. I want to be, you know, to have all this big twists and mysteries amount to something that impresses me and takes me off guard and really does something fresh. So far, there's been a lot of homage, and I appreciate homage, and it's keeping me around. And I think if I had no expectations at all and just stumbled across this, I'd be really interested. But I've just been burned so many times before. I'm not sure. I can't give myself fully to the show, and perhaps that's unfair to the show. But that's kind of where I am. I'm in this wait and see kind of thing.
Yeah, your likability of the show is trapped in its own little town in which it can't get out of for now.
Exactly. I can't leave.
I may have the opposite trajectory of you here. Maybe it's going back to this whole idea of lowered expectations being the key to happiness. But again, seeing M. Night Shyamalan's name being attached, I'm like, all right, let me just watch it and see what happens. And I thought that the first episode was actually very well done in terms of really slowly assembling this puzzle. And I think the second episode had some good moments, and it had some not so good moments as well. I may also be a little more high on it because reading some of the press, I know I read an article in Entertainment Weekly. I believe that the creator said that, you know, it's not going to be a wait until the end of the season to find out what's behind everything. I think they said in like episode 5, you're going to find out what's going on, which is like pretty crazy by network TV standards. And maybe it's going back against your idea of them not necessarily working to get renewed, them just trying to create a beginning, middle, and end, kind of like what happened a little bit with our little crossover from Broadchurch, Grace Point, which fell after only one season. But I've been enjoying it, and I think that also lends itself to the acting as well, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. I think there are some components that I don't really enjoy, I'll be honest, and I'll say I, when they keep going outside of Wayward Pines, the town, for scenes, I really don't care personally.
Yeah, it's the structure is very odd, because the first episode is, you know, we're in a certain point of view, and every time they went to Seattle, it completely takes you out of that. And, you know, we're in the era of Gone Girl, where the unreliable narrator was used to perfection. And I read that book first before I saw the movie, and certainly I was so impressed with the way the unreliable narrator was used in a way that was so fresh. I mean, off the charts, amazing. But in this one, my fear watching the first episode, which is, you know, pretty much a straightforward, hey, we're following this Secret Service agent and we're watching his life. And, you know, the second scene is, hey, you've had hallucinations in the past and you can't rely on what you're seeing is actually there. And red flags just go up at that point where I'm just like, is this whole series going to like be us debating whether or not this is in his head or not? And that would be so I'm out if that were the case. Thankfully, episode 2 completely changed the point of view. As we heard some conversations of people when he wasn't there in the town. You know, it led a little bit more, you know, it fleshed out the world a little bit more. But I agree with you. Every time they went to Seattle to his wife and son, who, I mean, I was just like bored silly. Like, and his son, I mean, maybe it's just the material. He wasn't given much, but like, wow. Cannot act.
No, I mean, I don't think it's like it's not Deborah Messing and Brian D'Arcy James' son on Smash level of bad, but it's still not great. But though I think it might lend a little bit to the writing as well, because this kid's just given like snide responses. Also, again, I don't want to like harp too much on this, on the negative parts of it, but man, this second episode when they're, you know, when she's inside with her sister, I guess, and she's like, I'm gonna go to Boise and I'm gonna see where Ethan went, and the conversation literally goes, the son says, I'm gonna go, no you can't, you have school, I'm gonna go, okay, like she's like, where did that come, what is dad the one that lays down the law in this household, apparently?
Apparently, I mean, yeah, we'll get back to that, because there's some issues with the family dynamics as well. But yeah, it's everything in Seattle. It's almost like once you've established the normal of the town of Wayward Pines, like Seattle is the bizarro world.
Yeah, though I will say one of the scenes that I really enjoyed that was in Seattle that was a little bit of a game changer, and it's hard to call anything a game changer in a series that in two episodes has had about 10 game changers within about the course of like 80 something minutes, was when Dr. Jenkins met with Ethan's boss from the Secret Service, and it turns out that I think it looks like the boss had kind of set Ethan up into whatever sort of program he's in right now in Wayward Pines, whether it be a program or not. And I think that also lends credence to your theory that it's not all in Ethan's head, considering that, again, we're seeing this conversation take place. And it also gets rid of the theory of like these people can't leave town. It's sort of like the island on Lost. There is a way to leave town. You just need to know how to do it.
Right. And this is where, like, to me, the whole first episode was a whole bunch of hodgepodge of these homages, because that whole agent being sent to an exiled place and, you know, being referred to as a number. I mean, this is classic The Prisoner, and Jenkins is even holding an umbrella in this scene. So, I mean, it's not an accident. This is totally, they're screaming, we're doing The Prisoner here, folks. So it is this kind of situation where I think there are all these ideas I've seen before, and what needs to propel the show is to put them in a different order and to build off that. Like, you know, it's fine, do the homage in the first episode, and I think there was enough of a divergence from this in episode two where I'm happy to continue watching, but it's walking a very thin edge here.
So let's start talking about some of the characters, because I think some of the twists and turns will kind of tie into the discussion of those characters. Let's start with our main guy, Secret Service agent Ethan Burke, played by the one and only Matt Dillon, Healy. AJ, are you enjoying Matt Dillon's performance so far?
I'm not. And I'm not a huge Matt Dillon fan to begin with, but I think he's horribly miscast in this role. He's actually very well cast if M. Night Shyamalan was going to direct him for the entire run, because I think he fits into his kind of stilted dialogue and not giving enough away. But I think you need someone who can sell this dialogue a little better. And so far I haven't seen it from him. He kind of just seems like, hey, I'm reading these lines. Hey, I don't know what's going on. You should listen to me. There's not enough there. And since he's the main character and we're supposed to be seeing the world through his eyes, it's a bit of a letdown for me to have him in the role. I'm trying to just, you know, I see Matt Dillon playing a role. I don't see this a fully fleshed out character.
I might be a little more positive on him than you are. I don't think the character is the most stellar to begin with. I mean, it's tough writing that role in the first place. The guy that's supposed to be, you know, sort of our straight man in the crazy town that is Wayward Pines. But then at the same time, to give him this whole convoluted background about how, you know, he was cheating on his wife with his former partner, and he has these, you know, he is feeling this immense guilt for a perp that he let go. So it's tough. I will say that Matt Dillon has a little bit of a case of the constantly furrowed brow, a la Mark Wahlberg in The Happening, where, granted, I know he's supposed to be confused at everything that's going on, but in two episodes, I don't think we've seen his brows rise even once. But I don't know. I may have more problems right now with the character than I do the actor. But that being said, I think the character is okay. I mean, I guess, are you rooting for the character in general? Because we're supposed to at this moment, I believe.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to, because he's our eyes. He's our POV. So, of course, you know, he's experiencing the town for the first time. And whoever is the character that's experiencing the town for the first time, that's, you know, that's who you're supposed to identify with. So certainly when all these bizarro people are interacting with him, you have to go along for the ride and you have to root for him, because in theory, if he meets his demise, the show is over and we don't learn anything. So yes, I'm with him and I'm rooting for him. I'm trying to. But again, the problem is that in the very opening sequence, you know, he wakes up, he doesn't know where he is. He wakes up lost style with the shot of the eye in the woods, and he's wearing a suit. And I'm just like, yeah, like, gee, where's the dog? I mean, that was all I was missing. But, you know, the very next thing we see is he's in a psychiatrist's office, and he's, you know, basically saying, am I having, you know, the psychiatrist says, are you having the hallucinations again? Because you have a lot of hallucinations and you see things that aren't there. And it's really hard to experience this world. We're supposed to be trying to figure out what's going on, where what we're seeing may not be going on. It's a tough sell to me. And so in that sense, the fact that he's kind of coming at this from a blank slate acting standpoint, I think it's an okay choice. I wish he was a little bit stronger in pulling it off without kind of like saying, hey, listen to me, do what I know what's right. Do what I say, listen to me.
Yeah. And that would be falling even more into the Jack wormhole, I feel, of like, be like, you need to, I'm giving the orders, you need to listen to me. I think I'm going to remain optimistic, and I'm going to say, once, granted, it's going to be only 10 episodes, but I feel like we're going to get a few episodes in and he's going to become more accustomed to the town, and then we'll be able to see some more spiked characterizations of him than kind of the blank slate we have right now. I want to move on to talk about some more roles played by more noteworthy actors, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about the other supporting roles, but a big character in these first two episodes, and maybe only two episodes, by the way, the second episode ended. Let's talk about Juliet Lewis here as Beverly, the bartender slash also apparently a prisoner of this town, but And this will open up the big first mystery. She is apparently 54 years old.
Yeah. I mean, did we have to throw a time travel wrinkle into this as well? But yeah, Beverly encounters him and says that she's been there a whole year. She's about to celebrate her year's anniversary in the town, and she's been there ever since 1999. There's a 14-year gap there that doesn't seem to jive with reality.
Also, I got to say, just to quickly interrupt, I mean, I have to kind of pick on that scene, too, where Ethan kind of talks to Beverly about how old she is by, like, doing the typical, like, almost like back to if they did Back to the Future now, like, they would you bring up these things of like, you don't even do you. And does Obama ring a bell? How about 9/11? Like, ah, oh, come on. You could write something better than that than trying to have her remember who Obama or what 9/11 was.
Oh, absolutely. That was just pandering to the audience, like, yeah, certain things, you know, trust an audience to get it, and I think that's just like really hitting it over the head repeatedly with a hammer and just saying, you know, it is 2014 when we filmed this, but even though it's not even 2014 now because we filmed this a year ago and it hasn't hit the air yet, but you know, that's just really lazy writing, and you don't need it. She said it's 2000, he says it's 2014. I get it, that's it, done, move on.
Yeah, I wonder how much of, and granted, I mean, this is it's been developed, and I think all the episodes are being written by this guy, Chad Hodge, who has a couple of smaller shows to his credit. I think the one that popped to my eye was The Playboy Club, which was the short-lived NBC show that was trying to, you know, pick up on all the Mad Men nostalgia fame. I'm sure it comes from the original books, too, but this whole time, you know, it's almost like we're in like a time chamber, adds a definite wrinkle to this idea of like, oh, they're just being held on some sort of compound, because like, if you do that, how are you also bending time?
Yeah, it like I said, I'm willing to give them the leeway to set up the mystery how they want. They better answer it. It seems unnecessary to have this extra wrinkle, although it does. In the first episode, the thing is that, you know, he meets Beverly and then he goes back to the bar/restaurant that he met her at the next day. And they say, no, there's no Beverly here. It's just two guys who work here. What are you talking about? And in that sense, at least having the time jump sets up the fact that, well, is he somehow in two different timelines at the same time, mm-hmm. and moving between the two? Or is he just wackadoodle and having a hallucination and Beverly doesn't really exist? In the whole first episode, we never see Beverly interact with anyone else. So in that sense, it sets up the, is he crazy? Is he not? And at least having the time things gives you a potential other option.
Yeah, though, I mean, it's just going to open up a bunch of other questions. And I'm sure we'll talk at the end about our own theories about what's going on a couple of episodes in, but again, we got a little sidetracked here. Going back to Juliette Lewis's character, what are your general thoughts on her?
I actually like her because I think she's having fun with the role, and you know, she's just right up front and she believes him right away. Anything he says, she believes, and in that sense, she's an honest in that first episode where she's like, yeah, okay, I believe you. Yeah, I never didn't believe you.
Yeah, cool. I do enjoy her in the role as like the person that's kind of the sidekick slash possible romantic partner, or as put upon them by Ethan's ex-partner and her husband. I will say, though, if the second episode revealed anything, is that she kind of sucks, considering that, I mean, she got herself killed, and she kind of blew up Ethan's plan by just kind of letting one comment slide and getting herself so worked up.
Yes. But, you know, this is kind of like, you know, we cover Survivor a lot. And I think it was almost like a Survivor thing where like they were on the way to tribal council and then he sprung this new plan on her and she didn't know how to react. But like, you would think he would tell her a little bit sooner in the day, like, oh, yeah, by the way, when we go out to this dinner, we're actually going to leave there and try and escape. So, you know, just want to let you know, like, you don't just spring that on her.
Yeah, that's true, though. I don't know what sort of, you know, she's been holding her composure for a year at this point. I don't know what if springing a new plan is so jarring to her that it reaches into the recesses of her memories and makes her inadvertently bring up her daughter.
Right. And you know, the other aspect of this you know, mystery is that she gives him a piece of paper that has on one side, it has her address. And she said, yeah, that if you need help, you need a place to stay, come visit me at the address.
I guess not her address, but maybe from what I believed, I think she was kind of giving him a clue and giving him the address to where that other agent was, you know, dead.
Or was she giving him her address and she just lives 14 years?
She just has a really weird roommate.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, I'm saying if we're dealing with this bizarre time rift, I mean, it's possible that she's existed 2000 and he exists 2014. Like, you know, the who knows what's going on there? I mean, it was like, you know, the modern day Jacob's Cabin.
Yeah,
it's
like, really,
oh, it's all burnt out. Where is it? Well, it's here now, but it won't be here later. You know?
Yeah, or like the well, and that suddenly just becomes a hole in the ground with a rope coming out of it.
Yeah, it's like, so I, you know, I don't know exactly what was going on with that, but you know, she screwed up the plan and she didn't listen to him at all. But at least in episode two, she's interacting with other people. So either everything's a figment of his imagination, which would be awful.
I just imagine him sitting there like, okay, and then there's going to be this other scene where Beverly, the bartender, is going to be talking to the sheriff's assistant and the nurse.
Exactly. So what,
that, you know, way we can pass the Bechdel test.
Indeed. They only hinted at another man in that scene. Yeah. So, you know, that's all I'm saying is that I think having her, once we've established in episode two that she does exist and she is in hallucination, at the same time, that's when she kind of like completely ruins everything and proves herself to be a far weaker character than she had set out to be.
Do you think she's dead?
Well, that's the thing. We're dealing with unreliable narrators. We're dealing with an entire town where everybody lies to everybody else. Everyone is playing a character of sorts. They're not who they say they are. They're not supposed to discuss who they used to be. So maybe it was all for show. I mean, you know, the savvy TV viewer who goes, well, Juliette Lewis is probably just getting ready to go to Secrets and Lies and didn't have a lot of time to shoot. You know, maybe that's in my head and thinking, yeah, she's just somewhere else to be. She signed up for two episodes, but you know, I don't know that. So yeah, would I be surprised in a show like this for her to like actually be the one in charge of the town three episodes from now? No. Not at all.
And also considering that we found out in that episode that apparently someone can both be witnessed to kill themselves and also be have their throat cut in front of the entire town simultaneously is somehow a thing that works in Wayward Pines.
Yeah. Although, you know, I don't know how we'll ever actually know the truth since we're not allowed to talk about the past, and that's in the past. So
we talked about the outsiders. Let's talk a little bit about these townspeople, and we're going to start with the biggest scenery chewers here. Let's talk about Melissa Leo as Pam the nurse.
Oh, she's fantastic.
I love her in, like, again, the most scene chewing ways. It's, you know, it's in very much in the same way as like you adore Cookie on Empire. You can tell Melissa Leo's having the most fun with those roles, and she is just playing up that crazy, mysterious character entity to the max. She's pushing up to 11, considering, I mean, one of her finest moments for me is when they were down, she caught him down in the morgue getting that little book out of the other agent's pants, and she just makes this really weird, like, bipolar thing, being like, "Oh, you, I know you miss your wife. You must be, you must want a banger or something like that." And I was like, "What?"
Yeah, she's like completely nutballs. And what's interesting about this is like it plays into the whole town's not able to process anything. Like, is she following orders from someone? Because, you know, in episode one, he escapes from the hospital after bashing her head into glass and causing her to bleed profusely and having this concussion and, like, you know, just beats the crap out of her, essentially. And she comes up to him in episode two as if nothing had happened. Like, hi. How, what are you doing here? Oh, you know, and she throws off the offhanded comment. But, like, you know, wouldn't the first thing you'd be like, you son of a bitch, you beat me up? No, she doesn't even mention it. It's almost like she's not allowed to mention it. And
yeah, that's what I think it is.
It's driving her bat-poo insane.
Yeah, it's almost like, I mean, if we could put this into another sort of realm or pop culture comparison, it would be the Truman Show as well. In terms of, I think there are these definite outsiders, but there are a lot of everyone else in the town has kind of either been programmed or paid or brought into this to kind of play their specific parts. And she definitely is playing this role of sort of Nurse Ratched's nicer sister almost, and that she's very controlling. You know, she put her foot in the elevator door in the first episode. She has her you know, kind of darker, demanding side, but at the same time, she always has that smile on her face, you know, saying, "A-okay, cowboy." And so she's a really interesting character to me. I also have a belief that I think when Ethan's trying to call the Secret Service and she keeps getting that quote unquote Marcy, the faux receptionist, I think that Pam is doing that voice.
Well, it's certainly possible and would not be surprising at all. And we certainly know he's not actually getting through to anyone because he at least he tested it in episode two. And, you know,
yeah, yet another brilliantly written scene. There is no reception desk on the seventh floor. Gotcha.
Yeah, here's a quick question, just plot wise. For does it bother you that we never see him calling his wife's cell phone?
I mean, the voicemail that he's constantly getting is for the home phone, right?
Yeah, clearly. And she's checking she's in Seattle checking her cell phone. And it's just, I mean, like.
I can assume that they probably loved that witty answering machine line about, like, you know, leave a message unless you're a telemarketer. They just wanted to use it again and again because they think it's so darn funny.
I guess, but that just drove me nuts. It's like, he's been checking, called his cell phone.
I don't know if you're hungry for ice cream, AJ. Let's grab some rum raisin. Let's talk about Terrence Howard as Sheriff Arnold Pope.
This is the character that just annoys me, the sheriff's department. I love Terrence Howard. I think he's doing a great job enjoying the scenery, but it's just the existence of this character. This is totally Twin Peaks. This is totally a ripoff of having the quirky receptionist and having the sheriff and you know, we're in the town and he's focused on food. It's so trying to pull off a Twin Peaks vibe. And it really annoys me because I love Twin Peaks so much. And it's not that it doesn't work. It's just that I don't need the ice cream thing to be repeated over and over again.
Yeah, the ice cream thing is a little weird. Again, I feel like for all these semi-normal town members, I think the nurse and the sheriff kind of stick out like sore thumbs in terms of, like, every time now that Ethan's basically seeing the sheriff, he's eating an ice cream cone.
And not just eating it, but commenting about it and saying how delicious it is. And it's just, it's like they're trying too hard to be quirky. And that just, it's not necessary. It really isn't. You can't just write quirky characters and say, oh, and he's always going to be eating ice cream. Or, she's always going to be doing this. She's got a catchphrase. You know, you can't do that. And it has to come organically. And this is not organic at all. And maybe it's just adding to the whole trying to annoy Ethan to the point where his mind breaks. And if they're trying to gaslight him in some way, and maybe that's, I'll you know, find out in retrospect and look back and go, okay, well played. But my fear is that they just said, you know, why don't we just give him ice cream and make it that his thing instead of, you know, damn fine coffee and hot or damn good cherry pie. Like, oh, this ice cream's good.
Well, how much you want to bet that the writers were craving Ben and Jerry's, or at least Ben and Jerry's sponsorship when they made that character up?
It would be delightful for them to have like only two billboards in town.
Yeah.
one of them be an ice cream company.
And that's the big twist, that it turns out that they're just in this like giant focus group for Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
Wayward Pines is made of people.
I'll have to say, and maybe it's because I do not have the Twin Peaks comparison to make in terms of lawmakers. I'm enjoying Terrence Howard's character. I'm enjoying probably the character more than the performance. I think Terrence Howard is, again, fine. It might be another case of what you were saying about Matt Dillon in terms of, I don't know how much he fits the character. And also, I realize I haven't heard Terrence Howard speak in a while, but Kenan Thompson actually does a surprisingly accurate impression of Terrence Howard, because Terrence Howard is very nasally. He's a lot more nasally than I remember him.
Yeah, I don't watch Empire, so I haven't seen him recently either. But Yeah, okay, Keenan, sure. As long as you know, Terrence Howard doesn't come out and start, you know, asking Ethan what up with that, I think I'm cool with it.
But I would totally expect this show to break out into a musical number at some point. But I think that the cool thing that Terrence Howard's character brings up for me, at least, is we saw him slit the throat of Beverly at the end of the second episode. And I'm wondering now, is he the de facto leader of the town? I mean, we haven't met the mayor of Wayward Pines yet, if he even exists. Are we to believe that the sheriff is like kind of the law enforcer and you know, head of the Wayward Pines people in a way?
I think so. I mean, he seems to be the only one that everybody fears. I mean, he's the one who gets up there. You know, he's kind of the Dean Norris of Under the Dome kind of guy who everyone turns to.
Big Jim, I think.
Yeah, Big Jim. And like, you know, like he's clearly in charge. He's the one who keeps mentioning the rules. And I think people definitely defer to him. So I would say I don't think, you know, I think we're in a certainly in a. In a show where we're going to see that there's a layer of oversight above him and then a layer of oversight above that. I'm sure we're going to get up, you know, down that rabbit hole at some point. But certainly in terms of the people we've met so far, he's the highest ranking official that we've met in town. He's certainly the enforcer, at least. Maybe he answers to Dr. Jenkins. We'll find that out. But he certainly seems to be the enforcer.
Yeah, and I will say that also his character, and we saw it a little bit in episode 2, it brings up a nice little conflict between Ethan has obviously had experience in criminal law, being a Secret Service agent, but, you know, he's been heading buds with the sheriff because the sheriff is trying to, I think, in part with this whole program to keep Ethan in line, is kind of saying, this is my territory, I make the rules here. So it'll be interesting to see them butt heads, though. Who knows? Maybe Beverly's execution has kind of hinted to Ethan, maybe you shouldn't be messing with the sheriff anymore.
Maybe. But, you know, it's just weird. It's just very weird. Ethan, one of the things that I don't get, like I said, I just don't get it. And I'm willing to watch and have them explain it to me. I'm not going to say that they haven't. And if they don't by the end, I'll be a little annoyed. But I don't get Ethan's place in this town because he... You know, he escapes from the hospital. They were gonna try and do surgery with him, and Nurse Pam was like all nut bars and like, I'm going to make sure that you get this surgery without having any anesthetic.
Yeah, so you have to feel every agonizing. I think there was a movie about that, very similar, like waking up in the middle of surgery.
Yes,
but yeah, and I also love the moment in the second episode where like Dr. Jenkins, they're trying to do a good cop bad cop routine almost, where Dr. Jenkins is like, okay, can you go through this procedure? And Matt Dillon's like, okay. And then Pam walks in and he immediately walks out. So you can tell who like the deal breaker is in that scenario.
Yeah. But you know, he escapes from the hospital in episode 1, thanks to Beverly. And then he just walks around town as if nothing has happened. And you know, like he escapes from the sheriff, and the sheriff is like, you stay in your hotel room.
I told you to stay in there. I'm not actually, I may put you in a cell.
Yeah, he just walks around town.
He arrested him for stealing a car, and he still let him go. He put him in house arrest.
Yeah, I don't understand. And then he, you know, don't go to the morgue. Whatever you do, don't go to the morgue. Oh, I'm going to go to the morgue. Like, it's an empty hospital except for the crazy nurse. Hey, who he's beaten up.
And maybe his wife and son. Who knows? Maybe that's an hallucination.
Yeah, or time jump. Time dilation is a bad. But, you know, I just don't understand. Why would he go back there? At least, you know, if he's going back there, he didn't have any fear of being caught. He wasn't lurking around. He just walked right into the morgue and started opening things up. And like, oh, hi, Nurse Pam, how are you? See, I got to go. It's just really weird. He's acting almost stranger than the people in town. And that it's unsettling to me. And I'm hoping that that's a good thing.
Let's talk about the one kind of transitory character that's kind of connecting Ethan's life in the outside world with the inner life of Wayward Pines. Let's talk about Kate Houston slash Ballinger, I think her new married name is. She's Ethan's former partner slash lover, and she was one of the people that he had to kind of, he was tasked to go track down and bring back to headquarters in Seattle. And it seems like, unlike Beverly, Kate is the one that she's also aware of the life that she once led, but she's much more about putting her nose down and saying, look, I have a nice life. Let me just keep it. What do you think about Kate's characterization, and especially how it kind of lies in contrast to what Beverly and Ethan are trying to do?
Well, I mean, yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense because we don't know her motivation at all. I mean, if her goal was to completely play, I'm part of this town and, you know, I've fully assimilated and I'm, you know, she could have just told him nothing. He should have just played the part like, I don't know who you are. But she didn't. She basically said, you know, sat him down and said, they're listening to us. Ixnay on the conversation, Kay.
Yeah, that's another thing, too. Not to derail this too much, but Ethan, it took him a long time to understand that every place is bugged. Like, even after he was, you know, after Beverly, like, held him close and was like, there's mics under the bar stools. He still went to Kate and was still like saying like, let's talk about, you know, I need to talk to you about the life that we had outside of this. And she's like, oh, why don't you go visit that old agent's wife? She has great gardening skills. Like, Ethan, you're a former Secret Service agent. You should probably be the one that would be the first onto the idea that everything is bugged.
Exactly. And even like in the first episode when he got the note that said there are no crickets in Wayward Pines, and he walks into the bushes and he hears the cricket, he reaches down and picks up this like little sound effects maker that's making the cricket sound, and he kind of like just goes, yeah, that's interesting. There's no real reaction from him. He just puts it back and goes, yeah, oh, what do you know? So, yeah, I don't get his motivations at all, but I don't get hers either because, you know, I thought if she's going to let him in and, like, try and help him that maybe she was on his side. But at the same time, she turned them in to the sheriff when they were planning to escape. And maybe she's got a little bit more information and she knows that in the long run, that's probably best for everybody. But it's just... It, without knowing her motivation, it's really hard to understand why she's doing what she's doing. I guess that's the mystery, isn't it?
Maybe it was revenge for Ethan not really caring about Harold winning the horseshoes tournament for the second year in a row.
Maybe, because, you know, but isn't that talking about the past?
Yeah.
Or does the past
talk about the past that's occurred in Wayward Pines, but you can't talk about the past, which again, I think we'll talk about our theories, but it may lead credence to a theory of like, maybe Wayward Pines is an assembled town of people who have had like troubled pasts. You know, like in Lost, we talk about, you know, the initial theory of was the island purgatory where people was everyone brought to the island because they were being punished for something because they did bad things in their previous lives before the plane crashed. You could argue maybe the same thing with Wayward Pines. I mean, granted, we only know a couple of these characters' backstories at this point, but it could very well be the case that, I mean, I have been reading, a graphic novel / comic book called Why, which is about like all a disease kills out like all the males in the world except for one. So it's a little post-apocalyptic, and they eventually go to a town that seems pretty idyllic for a post-apocalyptic world. And you find out that it's because it's being run by ex-convicts and they're like making sure to keep each other in check. So I wonder if that's sort of the thing that they're trying to set up, almost like a prison experiment.
Oh wow! That last man isn't Will Forte, is it?
No, a lot of. I read that very very soon to. I finished that very soon to the premiere though, so I had a lot of different things were tying in. I was very much predicting the end of the world, in which case I'd be the only one with a Y chromosome left, except for me and one monkey.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, we haven't. We have 8 episodes left to learn more about the people in the town. So, the fact that we don't have all the answers now, I'm fine with.
Yeah.
My red flags are the types of questions that are being asked. And that concerns me a little bit. But at the same time, I'm enjoying enough of the characters and enough of the story that I think if episode 3 gives us a few more characters and expands the town a little bit and starts to make the town the main focus as opposed to just necessarily Ethan's journey, then I think maybe we'll learn a little bit more and be able to figure out exactly what questions we're trying to answer, let alone, you know, just trying to figure out as we go along.
Yep, I agree with that. And I think one of the key pieces to that you were just talking about is Dr. Jenkins. And I know you brought it up before. Do you think... You know, we've seen Dr. Jenkins be the only person from Wayward Pines to be able to leave, and he had a scene in Seattle. Do you think he is, like, up more up in the hierarchy than someone like the sheriff in this town?
I think he would have to be because, you know, he's able to leave. And the only caveat being is that we haven't introduced the concept that time is not necessarily running the same way as in the outside world. So is it possible that the scene that we saw in Seattle actually took place before the scenes in Wayward Pines and he just shows up later on? It's possible. You know, we're not necessarily seeing things in sequence. So there's that aspect to it as well. It doesn't necessarily mean that he goes back and forth. It just means we're seeing him back and forth.
Yeah, that's true. This could be a thing that is sort of like if they took the film strip of Wayward Pines in chronological order and they just cut out all the cells and they rearranged them. Because we have, you know, stuff going on in Seattle, we have stuff going on in Wayward Pines, and we also have flashbacks. And it's not like, you know, we don't have the lost timpani cue that brings us into flashbacks. So we're just led to be, like you said, that second scene, which is, you know, Matt Dillon's character being talking to his psychiatrist about his hallucinations, you could have thought like, oh, maybe that comes after, or maybe that's when he shows up in the town. No, I guess it's a flashback since he's referring to a past event.
Yeah, we don't know. And for me, you know, seeing the psychiatrist who is currently Babineau on iZombie, I was instantly, you know, thinking, well, is he dead? Because I made that, you know, that zombie connection. You know, I know it has nothing to do with the show, but, you know.
No, it's a loose connection, but it's we might as well pursue it.
Yeah, it's like, who knows? Maybe he's dead all the time. I mean, you know, wasn't that the whole Sixth Sense thing? He's dead all the time. So you never know.
Yeah, that could be very true. Let's try to lay out right here. It's two episodes in. What kind of do we know? And that will lead into like what questions do we have? So I guess one of the things that we know, we've realized Ethan saw at the end of the first episode that it seems like the town of Wayward Pines is, first of all, there's kind of like this weird little like magical sort of once upon a time esque thing where like he was trying to drive out of the town. He ends up driving back in. So you can't pursue it by road. And when he, you know, walks through the woods, he finds that there is a giant electric fence around the town. And we see that there is a map that the old FBI agent drew that was very crude, but Ethan was still able to follow it perfectly. Like, considering it just said, like, park at the bottom. But Ethan was like, oh, yes, that tree. There's a bag in that tree. I will get the bag. That is the tree. Do you have anything you want to make right now of like this whole idea of the town being walled in, and also that mysterious shooter that Ethan saw on the rocks when he was in the tree?
Yeah, I don't have anything to say about the shooter because it was so quick and there was no context given to it at all. But like I said, this was just another example of me getting that prisoner vibe, the prisoner where, you know, he's on an island and he's trapped and, you know, he can't leave. There's no way out. You know, it meant to me that it's not going to be something where he can just leave. You know, he can't just walk out. He shouldn't even try, quite frankly. He's got to figure out the mystery. And it's a mystical cheat, but you know, I don't think there's like going to be a boat waiting on the other side of the fence or, you know, hot air balloon or anything like that. You know, is there an answer? Possibly. I think it's a red herring more than anything else. I think whatever he's got to go through the town, you know, he's got to come out the other side that way and figure out the mystery. He can't just escape it.
What do you think about the trackers, which they found out about and I'm assuming will be used a couple more times as the season progressed? First, I'm not a huge fan of Goron television. Anyone who listens to our Orphan Black recaps will know that. So considering we had a nice little 2-minute scene where it showed copious shots of them trying to dig the microchip out of Ethan's leg, did not make me like the episode anymore.
No, I you know, I cannot watch that kind of stuff when it's realistic. You know, if I'm watching Walking Dead and I know the zombies are going to be ripping out guts, I have no issue with it. I know it's just the magic of Greg Nicotero. But once you start doing actual, hey, I'm just going to take these tweezers and just rip this.
Yeah. And also it's weird from a programming perspective that you put the microchip in his leg. Well, because usually when I hear like, oh, you need to take out the microchip, I usually think it's like, oh, the microchip is in your head or like on your brain.
No, I've seen enough. I've seen enough different locations of this microchip, of the tracker. It's pretty much become a standard trope, I think. in terms of any show of this sort. You know, if you get held prisoner and somehow the escape is pretty easy from the jail, they've probably put a tracker in you, and it's kind of become standard, you know, TV operating procedure. So that didn't bother me. Finding it so quickly was a bit surprising to me.
Yeah, that is strange. But does the fact that these people are being, every one of their movements are being tracked, and maybe it's not the entire town, maybe it's just the outsiders that were brought in, if they're not all outsiders, does that allude to a larger power that's watching their every movement?
Yeah, it has to. I mean, you know, they kind of went over that when he walked past the camera store and the camera followed him, and then he gave his tracker to Beverly and then walked back and it didn't follow him. So, you know, clearly there's camera. If cameras are following you, someone's watching the cameras.
What, I mean, could this, we were talking about M. Night Shyamalan producing Big Brother, we were joking about it at the beginning. What do you think the chances are that this is sort of like a reality show, almost like the Truman Show? Because we have cameras everywhere and everyone's being tracked.
No, please no.
Second season of Utopia. This is Wayward Pines.
Oh, dear. Only if they bring back Huntress Hex.
Yeah, well, maybe she was the shooter on the
maybe
rock.
She was the shooter. Absolutely. Okay, sure. So Matt Dillon's going to go off and find his wife, and they're just going to say, just leave us alone. We're going to form the United Free State of Wayward Pines.
Yeah,
just
exactly.
Leave us alone.
The Wayward Pinesian States of Freedom.
Yeah, no, I hope it's not something that hackneyed.
I doubt it's going to be. But again, M. Night Shyamalan. But I'm assuming if it's coming from the books, then they'll go with the books. I don't think M. Night Shyamalan is pulling a David, a DB and David from Game of Thrones and saying like, screw the books. We'll use the books loosely.
No, I think the critics have seen the first five and they said that the twist, if that was the twist, they wouldn't be recommending that we watch it. And that's also part of the reason I'm sticking with it, because, you know, enough people have not spoiled it, but said, yeah, it's interesting. You know, no one's gone over and said, oh my gosh, you have to watch this, but no one's bailed either. So I'm like, okay.
Yeah, that's interesting though. I feel like, at least from what I've been surmising from online, it seemed like it was kind of panned before the season started. Maybe that was because of the marketing making it look a little too much like Twin Peaks or Lost. But now once the series has began, I think the reception has been a lot warmer from what I've
seen. Absolutely. I mean, like you said, the first premiere was opposite Scandal's finale and it got like a one. And then when they factored in the plus three, it did much better, and so I think people just decided to you know, TiVo it, and DVR, and watch it later, and or wait till next, you know, this past week when they showed them back to back. So I think people are watching.
Wait, AJ, you used the term TiVo. What year do you think you're in? Have you heard of iPads?
Wait, hang on. My MySpace account needs to be updated here.
Oh my god. AJ, do you still have state quarters?
What? States?
What?
I'm here in the colonies. What are you talking about?
Oh my god, mind is blown. We have our own little colony here on Post Show Recaps. That's our big secret. All right, I know this is super early on. We're only two episodes in, but let's play a little bit of the extrapolation role here, AJ.
Yes.
Is there any sort of theory, no matter how far-fetched it can be, that you can come up with as to what the end game for Wayward Pines is, what the big twist is behind what's going on?
Yes, and I'm going to preface this by saying I only know the two episodes. I have not looked ahead. I have not read anything that spoils anything in the future. I've not read the books, so this is as cockamamie as it comes, and it's coming out of this bizarro brain of my own. But I cannot believe that the son is this bad of an actor and was allowed to stay in the show. And like you said, he talked himself into going on this trip to Boise really, 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 really easily. And there's this homage thing that's going on with all these you know, TV shows and shows of this mysterious nature. And the vibe that I'm getting most of all from this town is that Twilight Zone episode where the little kid has like magical powers and can wish people into the cornfield. And I'm getting that vibe from the sun. And I'm getting that vibe from the kid who drove by on the bicycle and like the sheriff said, like,
don't try to leave, Mr. Burke.
Yeah, he knew who he was, which is kind of weird. And the sheriff kind of like stopped what he was doing. Like, he's like, hey, how's it going? Good. On a bicycle. Get on a bicycle. I think that we're in like a Children of the Corn thing here, where the kids all have telekinetic powers and they're the ones in control of the town. And eventually his son's going to end up in the town somehow and become the ruler. Thank you. That's my Twisto's twist of the week.
Arguably the worst actor in the show will become the overall leader.
He's so bad that it's a long Ben Linus is Henry Gale kind of con going on here.
So I'll come up with a theory, and I won't take 100% credit for it. I did read the AV Club synopsis of the first two episodes, and they threw out a theory that I really enjoyed, which I think will explain a lot of this whole time paradox thing. And my theory is that everyone who comes into the town, Dr. Jenkins. Yes, Dr. Yes. Such a common name. I'm surprised I forgot about it. Dr. Jenkins, I think him and these other programmers, whoever they may be, watchers, made clones of everybody. So that when somebody dies or, you know, they try to escape and they get killed off, they're replaced by somebody else. And that's why I think we have the weird double story where the old agent both killed himself and got tortured and his throat slit in front of the entire town. That's why I personally think that we'll have Juliette Lewis back. And I think we're going to have like just a new Beverly clone that's back as well. And that's why all these characters, you know, remain the same age, in spite of the fact that 14 plus years have gone on, is that they're just constantly being replenished at the same age in which they entered the town.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, you know, I've seen nothing that can be used to disprove that as the truth.
Maybe I'm just crossing the streams too much with Orphan Black than I'm really going down this clone path. But you know what? I might as well stick to my guns here.
Well, it's kind of, you know, with the island movie where, you know, there were the clones on the island. So, yeah, I you know, harvested for their organs. I can see that. I can see that. It's certainly, you know, if we're going to throw all the tropes on the table.
Yeah. That's
it's no more ridiculous than mine.
Yeah, exactly.
In my theory.
I think that's one of the fun things that the creators were trying to market to this show too, is that like, hey, try to guess what's going on. You know, you can make as many guesses as you'd like to. So, you know, I think we might as well just keep throwing the suggestions out there, and you guys do it as well. AJ, do you have any more things you'd like to talk about with these two episodes, or should we start wrapping this thing up?
No, I think we've covered most of it. I just, you know, to me, the speed at which the plot is progressing is actually pretty nice for the 10 episodes. I think had they had another full episode where it was just, you know, Ethan running around town and everyone like not talking to him or giving him, you know, still cover stories and him trying to uncover it. If it had become that for like three more episodes, then I would definitely would have been disappointed and just stopped watching. But, you know, already we saw in the second episode, we saw potential hallucinations interacting with each other, which kind of puts that theory to rest. We kind of had characters' point of views that weren't his. And so we're starting to see a little bit more of some answers to questions that maybe we didn't have. The four rules, we didn't really go into the four rules of the town, but like, you know, that kind of this kind of establishing like this is what the people in the town are dealing with, and the fact that one of the rules was always answer the telephone, and you know, when they escaped, all the telephones in town rang, and that was kind of cool. And it kind of became this kind of instant gratification of that rule. Like, oh, that's why you answer the telephone, because it means someone's escaping. You know, I like that kind of, we don't have to wait three more episodes to find out what the telephone thing is. You know, it's there right away.
So there will be more coverage of Wayward Pines coming up in the next several weeks. We're still trying to figure out exactly what that coverage may be. You may see some more coverage in a couple weeks. You may see it at the end of the season. I would say definitely at least end of the season, because I think this show is enough of a roller coaster ride that we want to cover at least how everything ends and how it may end altogether, depending on if it goes the way of Grace Point in last one season. But this was a lot of fun. Please reach out to AJ. He is at AJ Mass on Twitter. And if you're interested in sports and baseball as well, AJ has has your back covered. He's covering everything that's going on with the MLB in addition to all the crazy stuff going on with Wayward Pines. How does the MLB compare to the town of Wayward Pines in terms of all the crazy stuff and rules that are going on?
Yeah, I mean, the rule is you can't have pine tar or foreign substance on your hand, and suddenly pitchers are doing it and getting 8-game suspensions, and, you know, you got teams that were in last place last year, suddenly they're in first place, and they have no idea how they got there.
they're all wearing suits, and they all have their noses were cut open.
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. So, yeah, I think it's the similarities are endless.
Yeah. As always, you can reach me at a Mike Bloom type on Twitter. Lots of stuff going here on here on Post Show Recaps. We are still doing weekly recaps of Orphan Black. I'm doing that with Jessica Lease. Obviously, Game of Thrones is still chugging along with Rob Cesternino and Josh Wigler. SNL is finishing its coverage up. You'll probably hear me a few more times over the weekend, doing a couple other podcasts, stuff coming up in the next couple weeks. All very exciting stuff. AJ, you brought up a fun little hashtag. Let's go with hashtag Wayward Pine Tar, if you've made it this far, in honor of the banned product that I'm assuming is one of the main exports of Wayward Pines. AJ, again, thank you so much for coming on to do this with me and talk the craziness of this show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Mr. Bloom. Always a pleasure.
All right. So hashtag Wayward Pine Tar. If you've made it this far, thank you guys so much. You'll be hearing from us soon. Don't know when. Just make sure when you do, you answer that phone. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.